Welcome to the Federal Society's Practice Group podcast. The following podcast, hosted by the Federal Society's Free Speech and Election Law Practice Group, was recorded on Thursday, September 21st, 2017, during a live teleforum conference call held exclusively for Federal Society members. Welcome to the Practice Group's teleforum conference call. It's today we discuss the upcoming Supreme Court case on political gerrymandering, Gill versus Whitford. I'm Dean Reuter, Vice President, General Counsel, and Director of Practice Groups here at the Federalist Society. Please note that all expressions of opinion are those of the expert on today's call. Also, this call is being recorded for use as a podcast in the future. We're very pleased to welcome, I think, two brand new guests to Teleforum Conference Call, Professor Nicholas Stephanopoulos. He's a professor of law at the University of Chicago Law School. We're joined also by Mr. Kevin St. John. He's a partner at Bell Giftis St. John. We're going to get opening remarks from each of them for about 8 to 10 minutes, then maybe a little bit of back and forth, but as always, questions from the audience, so please have those in mind for when we get to that portion of the program. With that, Professor Stephanopoulos, the floor is yours.
Terrific. Thank you very much, and thanks to the Federal Society for organizing this great event and for inviting me to be one of the discussants. And it's really quite a treat to be having this discussion of Whitford with a really terrific lawyer on the other side of the case, Kevin, who is also counsel on what I thought was the most effective and the most powerful amicus brief that was filed on behalf of appellants. So it's a really nice event that we have organized here. And the timing of the event is also great as well, given that the Supreme Court's oral argument in Whitford is coming up now in less than 2 weeks. So for my remarks, I thought I would take a bit of a step back from the sort of the thrust and parry of the case itself. And instead, I wanted to talk about the nature of voting and the nature of legislative representation in modern American politics. And after doing a bit of that high-level discussion, I'll then connect what the nature of voting and of representation, what they mean for both partisan gerrymandering and the need for judicial intervention in Whitford and in cases like Whitford. And I'll be very happy to get into specifics later in the call, whether it's about the three-part doctrinal test that we're proposing for partisan gerrymandering, or whether it's about the particular statistical methods and metrics that we're employing in the case. I'm eager and happy to discuss all of those topics as well. So let me start off with voters in today's American political system. When they go to the polls, how do they decide how to cast their ballots? Is it primarily based on the specific candidates who are running, the records of incumbents while in office, the issues that are debated during the campaign? Or do most voters, most of the time, make their decisions on the basis of partisan affiliation, on the basis of their own attachment to a particular party and a candidate's party label? So Kevin's brief asserts, based on what I think are a handful of not particularly representative examples, that voters, for the most part, are making their decisions based on candidates, issues, incumbents, records, et cetera. The reality in Wisconsin and in virtually all states around the country is that partisanship dwarfs all the other drivers of voter behavior, at least at this current historical moment. I'll mention a couple kinds of evidence that support that conclusion. One has to do with the prevalence of split-ticket voting. So take Wisconsin, where I know the data. If you imagine a chart with the vote for Republican assembly candidates on the x-axis and votes for Republican presidential candidates on the y-axis, there is virtually a perfect relationship between those two variables. So in other words, only a tiny minority of Wisconsin voters split their tickets, and the vast majority of Wisconsin voters, Democrats and Republicans, vote for the same party, both in assembly races and in non-assembly races, like the presidential election. Notably, this was absolutely the case even in 2016, when Donald Trump's candidacy supposedly broke all the normal rules of politics. Split ticket voting in Wisconsin was nearly zero, and there was something like a 98% correlation between assembly voting and presidential voting. So the second kind of evidence that I have in mind here has to do with the consistency of voters' preferences over time. And here too, imagine a chart where you have Republican assembly votes in 2012 on one axis, and then Republican assembly votes in 2016 on the other axis. Once again, there is virtually a perfect relationship between those two variables. The 2012 assembly vote is essentially a perfect predictor, with something like 98-99% accuracy of assembly voting in 2016. So the vast, vast majority of Wisconsin voters supported the same party in two quite different elections 4 years apart from each other. Let's turn next to legislators, so the elected members of legislatures in Wisconsin and elsewhere. Do we see a bunch of moderate representatives in competitive districts and a bunch of much more extreme representatives in safe districts? That's what Kevin's brief asserts. And again, on the basis of a number of examples that I don't think are actually representative. Or conversely, do we see a very high level of legislative polarization in Wisconsin and elsewhere, where basically all Democratic legislators are quite liberal and all or almost all Republican legislators are quite conservative? So once again, the evidence really is overwhelming in Wisconsin and in other states that there is extremely severe legislative polarization. And the upshot of extreme legislative polarization is that district composition, so how competitive or how safe a given district is, has almost no effect on the voting record or the ideology of the representative. And this is backed up empirically. So if you imagine a chart with the legislators' voting record on the y-axis and the margin of victory for the winning candidate in the last election on the x-axis, there is almost no connection between the two. There's a massive jump in voting record and in ideology based on whether the elected legislator is a Democrat or a Republican. But within the Democratic Party or within the Republican Party, there's just about no link between the makeup of the district and the behavior of the legislator. Okay, so why am I talking about these things, and how are they connected to partisan gerrymandering or to the Whitford case? So let me start with voter behavior. Voter behavior matters because it affects the durability of partisan gerrymandering. So if voters ignore party labels, make their decisions every time based on the issues and candidates in that election, then gerrymandering wouldn't be durable at all. You'd make predictions about how districts would perform, but those predictions would mean very, very little in future elections with different issues and different candidates. On the other hand, if voters' partisan preferences are quite fixed, then gerrymandering is a lot more durable. In that case, predictions about how districts will perform are a lot more accurate, and many fewer districts are likely to flip from one party to another as we go through the elections that a plan is in effect. And empirically, it turns out that gerrymandering is indeed very durable. So when we have a map that exhibits a large asymmetry or a large degree of unfairness in one election, typically that asymmetry or that unfairness persists for the rest of the decade. With a map like Wisconsin's Act 43, which has a huge asymmetry, we can be virtually certain, based on modern voter behavior, that that asymmetry is not going anywhere. You know, it's going to endure for the rest of the decade. Okay, and then second, the behavior of legislators matters because it helps to shape the consequences of gerrymandering for democracy, for the whole political process. So if we're in a world where legislators largely reflect the views of their constituents, then gerrymandering has very little impact on the political process. In that world, it doesn't really matter whether a district elects a Democrat or a Republican, and the overall composition of the whole legislature also has very little effect on enacted policy. On the other hand, if, as they are, legislators are highly polarized, then it matters an awful lot whether a Democrat or a Republican is elected, and the overall partisan composition of the legislature again matters an awful lot. And that's because having more Democrats in the legislature due to pro-democratic gerrymandering will get you more liberal policy outcomes, thanks to the consistent liberalism of almost all Democratic legislators. And then conversely, if gerrymandering enables the election of a lot more Republican legislators, they're going to be consistently conservative members of the legislature, and the output of the legislature will be consistently conservative. And again, empirically, we see exactly this pattern. So when there's a large gerrymander in favor of a particular party, the enacted policy in that state swings dramatically in that party's preferred ideological direction. And crucially, this happens even though no voters are actually changing their minds or being persuaded. The voters are just being placed or aggregated into different districts, and based on that aggregation, the whole political system of the state skews in either a liberal or a conservative direction. So in conclusion, that's why I think judicial intervention to curb partisan gerrymandering is so important and so necessary at this historical moment. The partisanship of voters in today's America means that gerrymandering today is highly durable. It's highly unlikely to evaporate on its own, and only courts can disrupt the gerrymander and prevent its persistence for the rest of the decade. And then the partisanship of legislators means that today's gerrymandering is very democratically subversive. It's very likely to produce representation and to produce policy outcomes that simply don't reflect, indeed that flout the will of the electorate. And that's the classic kind of democratic injury that courts have always intervened, at least for the last half century or so, to prevent. So I'll stop there and I'll turn it over to Kevin to tell me why I shouldn't be so concerned about partisan gerrymandering in Wisconsin and elsewhere. Thanks a lot.
Thank you, Nick. And thanks for your kind comments earlier, and thank you to the Federalist Society for hosting this call on an important issue. I was going to talk today, I was going to start a little bit with more of the abstract theory of representation and why substantive representation or proportional representation is not a constitutional norm. And I was also going to talk a little bit about how this idea that whether there is a constitutional norm should not depend on whether or not candidates or parties or legislators at any particular moment in time are polarized. It doesn't make sense that the Constitution would change based on some shifting behaviors that elected officials may have. But I think that Nick's conversation opened the door to talking a little bit about why people do vote. And I thought I'd just start there, and maybe later we can turn back to the constitutional issues. I think inherent in the challenger's theory of the case is an extraordinary skepticism that the First Amendment actually functions, right? Now, ultimately, the First Amendment has got two consequentialist rationales behind it. One is that it's an indispensable feature of self-government that we are able to talk about political ideas and political matters so that we can participate in the democratic process. And you know, the second, of course, is the marketplace analogy. The idea is that the best ideas prevail through the competition in the marketplace. And it's through dialogue that we separate good ideas from bad ideas and truth from falsity. And it's not hard to see how these consequentialist claims that underlie the First Amendment are ultimately applicable to the political world, right? Information communicated by candidates or to candidates, it matters directly for the purpose of self-government. Information informing perspectives on the underlying political issues of the marketplace, that matters too. And indirectly, it influences elections, particularly if candidates or party platforms don't keep up with consensus views. These consequentialist rationales presume that people are capable of changing their minds, right? And the challenge's core assumption, I think, in Gill, as Nick has articulated well, is that partisan affiliation drives vote every office up and down the ticket over time. People affiliate with a party, they vote for a party. If you know their party affiliation, you could draw lines to win. Everything else is just noise. You know, the variation among candidates, their ability as individuals to forge or reflect consensus, that doesn't matter. The scope of the offices, that doesn't matter. Personal charisma of candidates, that doesn't matter. Voters change their minds on issues? Nope, they don't. Or if they do, they don't care if their party doesn't follow suit, because the assumption is that people don't change their party affiliation. In the alternative, the theory is that parties don't change their positions on issues. And if they do, then their followers will just sheepishly follow, right? There are so many problems with this voters as robots, candidates as fungible, parties as static assumption that Professor Stephanopoulos makes. I just disagree with it. First, we know by indirect election behavior, not at the polls, but before the polls, that it's not true. Candidates, parties, advocacy organizations, they spend millions and millions of dollars trying to convince people to support a given candidate or a given issue that the candidate supports, or simply getting out the vote. And they wouldn't do this if there weren't minds out there to convince. Second, we know by self-identification it's not true. So Gallup takes a monthly poll of voter partisan self-identification. If partisan affiliation is a strong driver of voters, well, let's figure out how do people affiliate with parties? Because in Wisconsin, we don't register. We don't register as members of Republicans or Democrats. We kind of have to guess at what this is based upon votes, kind of a backwards-looking thing. But in terms of the Gallup poll about how do people answer the question, it's been 8 years since more people answered this monthly poll and said that I am a Democrat or I am a Republican versus I am an independent. And during the past decade, Republican affiliation has ranged from about 19-20% to 33%, self-identified Democrats between 25% and 39%. Clearly, the plurality of Americans don't see themselves as partisans. Partisans change their affiliation, some departisanize, and others eventually pick a side. And third, we do know by electoral results that this monolithic idea of the voter isn't true, because people do split their tickets and change their minds all the time. And while you might look at something like an aggregate correlation of 98%, right, we do district-based elections in this country, right? And so it's really important to look at, well, what are the variations within different elections? So, you know, for example, one of the elections that we pointed out in our brief was that there were two representatives, Travis Tranel and Lee Narrison, who outperformed Mitt Romney in 2012 by 14 and 16% respectively. And importantly, it was about the views of the constituencies, or at least in part. You know, both of those Republican Assembly candidates voted against Governor Scott Walker's Public Sector Labor Reform Act. Fourth, we know that districts, you know, they're not static in their preferences over time. So back to Wisconsin. In 2008, President Obama won 59 of Wisconsin's 72 counties. Those counties are static, obviously, geographic areas. Donald Trump in 2016 won 60. You know, consider the efficiency gap of that score if it were county-based districts. The point is that two-thirds of the state's counties flipped. And what's more, you know, when we had even elections, so basically the President Bush elections in 2000 and 2004 and the Trump election in 2016 were virtual ties in Wisconsin, all within a percent of 50 in a two-party vote. But, you know, we find out that President Trump ended up winning 15 counties that Bush failed to carry, that his vote share over President Bush was 8% or more increase in half of Wisconsin's counties. Secretary Clinton, by contrast, was only picking up votes in significant numbers in two counties, which were Dane County, where Madison is, and Milwaukee County, where Milwaukee is. Those are our two most urban areas in our state. You know, and this shows, obviously, that voters aren't equally distributed throughout. And if you have any kind of principles that are going to involve communities of interest, contiguity, compactness when you're drawing maps, you know, your voters don't live in random distributions throughout the state, and there's going to be some kind of a political geography effect. The next thing I think it's important to know, or fifth, is that while it may be a 2% deviation, for example, from a presidential election as an aggregate to a statewide election on an aggregate, by the way, a statewide election that never happened, right, because people only have district-specific elections. One of the things to point out is that in about 30% of the seats that have been contested twice in Wisconsin since we've had this new map, the last three election cycles, because we have votes every 2 years, a candidate got more than 8% above what was sort of the partisan baseline score of that district. So we're talking about in large numbers of large variations and large swings that can happen. And that's independent of the map's overall tilt. That's just looking at a single district and how somebody can perform. And it's just been the fact of the matter has been is that Republicans in Wisconsin have performed particularly well independent of these types of variables. And how well they performed actually perversely ends up making the challenger's discriminatory effect argument, at least under their theory, a stronger argument. So let me give you a couple of examples on this. There, Wisconsin legislature, this map has 29 competitive districts, the kind of districts that are between 45 and 55. Republicans have won 91% of those contested races in those districts since this act was passed that leaned Republican, and 74% of the contested races in those districts that leaned Democrat. So it's not a surprise ultimately that where the money is spent, where the candidates campaign hardest, where the parties have concentrated those efforts, the places where there is basically a bonus win for capturing the minds of undecided, Republicans have performed far better. And that's an effect that is independent of how maps are drawn. The point here is really that even if political affiliation is a primary driver, there are other drivers that are significant, and that's where elections are won and lost. A map doesn't cause an independent voter to vote one candidate or another. A map doesn't cause a voter to stay home. A map doesn't cause someone to change their mind on abortion or gun control or tax policy. A map doesn't cause a political party to have a platform that contains unpopular views. A map doesn't determine whether or not, for example, a party will have litmus tests for voters, so they won't have positions that might not be the party line but might be more popular in a given constituency. A map doesn't find a self-funded candidate. A map doesn't limit the number of campaign volunteers. A map doesn't organize the effectiveness of how of those campaign volunteers. Basically, I'm saying that it's not just noise. Free choice of voters is not just noise. Their responsiveness to arguments is not just noise. Those are the places that elections are won and lost. And I think that an attempt to connect a map to a cause of an effect ultimately is a misguided effort because it will fail to capture that there are many complicated reasons that people vote, and that even if it isn't even if those independent variables are not the primary driver, they are the driver that are the difference between winning and losing elections. I turn it back over to the moderator.
Well, thank you very much, gentlemen. There does seem to be a difference of opinion between our two speakers, so I'm going to give each of them a chance to sort of augment and expand their remarks. But first, let's let our audience members begin to queue up. In a moment, we'll all hear an announcement that will say the floor mode is on. After you hear that announcement, if you have a question for our guests, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. So we've got a lot to discuss on both sides. Before we go to the audience, I do want to give Professor Stephanopoulos maybe a minute or two. If you could just pick out one or two items and respond to them, and then we'll go to Kevin St. John once again. But Professor Stephanopoulos.
Sure. Thank you very much. I'll limit myself to just a single point, which is that the drafters of Wisconsin's current plan, you know, the staffers and the lawyers who spent 4 months locked up in a room drafting the map with meticulous care, they certainly seemed to think that the lines they were drawing would make a big difference. You know, they certainly seemed to think that the map they were drawing would shape Wisconsin politics over the next decade. At a more granular level, not one of their analyses accepted any of the assumptions that we just heard from Kevin. So every one of their elaborate statistical examinations assumed the Democratic and Republican legislators were fungible. There was precisely zero effort to distinguish between extreme Democrats and centrist Democrats, or between extreme Republicans and centrist Republicans. All Republican legislators were R's in their view, and all Democratic legislators were D's in their view. When it came to voters, similarly, there was none of the nuance that we just heard from Kevin. There was no effort to figure out how voters might respond to one issue platform or another. There was no consideration of turnout, of money in politics, of tailored campaigns, of any of that. They used nothing but statistical evidence. They treated voters as automatons. They used aggregate past election data, and exclusively aggregate past election data, in order to assess the performance of the map. So every single thing that Kevin says the plaintiffs here are guilty of, Act 43's own drafters are equally guilty of that. The plaintiffs here have used precisely the same data and the same methods as Act 43's drafters. The difference, of course, is that Act 43's drafters use that data and use those methods in order to craft a durable and extreme partisan gerrymander, whereas the plaintiffs here are using that same data and those same techniques in order to detect a gerrymander and to try to convince the courts to invalidate such a map.
Mr. St. John, a minute or two.
Well, sure. I want to just say that in terms of the record evidence, what the drafters are doing in that case and the data that they were used, it's not like it was used for the same purpose as far as predicting what was going to happen in an individual election. And if you make the jump from one set of data to another, or one purpose to another, you're ignoring what it is that the court actually has to grapple with. And the court has to grapple, I think, primarily with the question of, do we even have a constitutional right at stake? And then secondarily, do these tests that we have assess, or are they reliable tests, comprehensive tests, to assess the phenomena that we think is constitutional? But I want to just make a couple comments on whether the phenomena is constitutional. You know, I think that at the end of the day, what Challenger's argument and all of this is that there's a problem if there isn't some kind of proportional representation. And they say it's not proportional representation, but by any reduction, the supposed constitutional problem they point to is evidenced by some kind of a deviation from an ideal of a proportional partisan representation. Partisan symmetry is ultimately, fundamentally, it's going to be the same thing. It doesn't matter if it doesn't require a one-to-one ratio of votes to seats. The sign-flipping point is going to ultimately be in the same place. And I think it's important to emphasize that there's no constitutional basis for this theory or historical support, and that shouldn't surprise us, right? There's many theories of representation by area, by population, substantive representation, which is representation by viewpoints, descriptive representation, consider representation by an occupation, occupational classes or ethnic groups. And advocates for all of these theories of representation argue that their preferred theory provides for better representation. And that could mean pure translation of the public will, it could mean more effective government, it could be sometimes it means the better protection of minority interests. And no matter the theory of representation, right, there are different theories about how to select representatives and how that best sort of enforces or gives life to those norms, right? These forms, they serve different conceptions of those representation theories and normative goals, right? You can have first past the post elections. That means one thing. Multi-member districts has a different result. Party list balloting would have a different result and enforces, supports different values. Ranked voting, a different result. Now, how does the Constitution deal with this? Well, the one-person, one-vote rule embodies, as a constitutional rule, the primacy of representation by population. Wisconsin's constitution requires representation by area as well, because districts must be contiguous. But there's no legal rule that embodies a theory of substantive representation or descriptive representation, or even nudges in that direction, right? And I think it's helpful to think about substantive and descriptive representation as being equally sort of not embodied by the Constitution, either expressly or by form. So I think, for example, it would be absurd. Most people think it's absurd to think that the Constitution requires descriptive representation. You know, for example, a set aside of a number of seats for ethnic groups or occupational groups, and that the Constitution doesn't require proportional representation of race in legislative bodies strikes me as pretty compelling that it doesn't require it for partisan affiliation either. Right? It's not unconstitutional vote dilution of minority votes if a legislative body isn't comprised of a proportional percentage of members of a minority group. And that's a descriptive classification especially protected against discrimination by the Constitution. So why would the Constitution consider it unconstitutional vote dilution if a legislative body isn't comprised of a proportional percentage of members of a political party, which is a mutable descriptive classification that's not specifically protected by the Constitution from discrimination? Last is that we've always followed this English model of electing candidates and not parties, and we've always done so through first-past-the-post winner-take-all elections. District-based, candidate-based, winner-take-all elections are fundamentally inconsistent with partisan substantive statewide elections. Getting past the post means winning it all, and that's a normative component of our system and one that subordinates whatever value, and I think there is some value, but it subordinates whatever value there is to a substantive proportional representation. I don't want this to be lost. Challengers raise legitimate ways to think of representation, but they reinforce different normative principles than the ones that our founders selected. Some countries prefer substantive representation. They've got proportional electoral systems to make clear that that's the goal. But we have not chosen that approach. And there's no reason to believe that the normative values that are enhanced by electoral systems that have been rejected are still constitutionally compelled. You know, that's not to say they're not significant values, only that they should be the subject of legislative balancing as opposed to a constitutional command. That's what we do with all values that are not specifically protected by the Constitution. You know, I think that challengers are ultimately lodging a criticism of proportion-based representative system where the representatives are chosen in winner-take-all elections. The substantive gerrymandering theory isn't compelled by the Constitution. I actually think that their theory is an attack on the Constitution's architecture. Something that is not a constitutional value and has been rejected as the way that we do elections shouldn't serve as a baseline for a constitutional claim.
All right. We do have a lot on the table here. We have one caller with a question. If you would like to ask a question, you need to push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. We've got fully 30 minutes or so left in our call. Push the star button, then the pound button on our telephone. Let's take our first call of the day.
Hi. I know the efficiency gap seems to play a role in the district court's opinion. Could you kind of explain what that is and whether or not it's fairly widely accepted as a principle?
Sure. Is that a question better directed at me? This is Nick. I assume I can begin, and then we can hear some criticisms of the efficiency gap from Kevin.
Sure. Go right ahead.
That's good.
Professor Stephanopoulos.
Great. So the efficiency gap is one of a handful of metrics that social scientists use to measure the extent or the severity of partisan gerrymandering. And it's not the only such metric, and it's not the only such metric that we rely on in this litigation. But I think it's a high profile metric at the moment. And I think it's one that has certain advantages that other quantitative measures of gerrymandering don't have. So what it is a measure that tries to quantify the impact of the two classic techniques of partisan gerrymandering. So all partisan gerrymandering in Wisconsin and in any other jurisdiction always takes place through the techniques of cracking and packing. So either cracking the opposing party's voters, which means dispersing them over a large number of districts where they consistently vote for the losing candidate, or packing the opposing side's voters in a small number of districts where their preferred candidate wins, but does so by an overwhelming majority. So the key insight here is that both cracking and packing produce what we call wasted votes, which are votes that are unnecessary to the election of the winning candidate. So in a crack district, all of the votes that are cast for the losing candidate are wasted. You know, they don't go to elect anybody. And in a PAC district, all of the votes for the winning candidate above the 50% plus one threshold that's necessary for victory, those votes are wasted as well. You know, the winning candidate could have prevailed even without those extra votes. So the efficiency gap just takes the total of one party's wasted votes over all of the districts in a plan, subtracts from that total the other party's total wasted votes across all of the districts in a plan, and then divides that difference by the total number of votes cast in the election. And so the idea is that in a single easy-to-use number, the efficiency gap tells you which party is the beneficiary of the cracking and packing in a district plan, and how large is the party's advantage from the differential cracking and packing. And so again, I think this is an intuitive measure that corresponds to the classic techniques that are always employed in partisan gerrymandering, but I don't want to claim it's the only such measure. There are other metrics, too, that have their pros and cons and that we happily rely on as well in this case.
Kevin St. John, you want to jump in
sure.
here?
Sure. The different social science theories have different pros and cons, which I think ultimately means different ones will alert to a partisan gerrymander that is durable than other ones, and that the ones that will be used by litigants in the case are the ones that work for the particular case. In terms of the efficiency gap itself, I think there's a couple of sort of fundamental objections to how well it does at identifying partisan gerrymandering that I want to just get out on the table, and I'd be really happy to actually listen to Nick's response to them, because they are criticisms that are sort of common in the literature, and it'd be interesting to hear how he responds to them. The first is not a social science type of criticism, but is rather that, you know, the baseline is how did people vote statewide, right? That's going to be a baseline. And we just never, ever have legislative statewide races. In Wisconsin, for example, I mean, we have between 40 and 50% of our assembly races are not contested, right? Or at least in this last term. It tends to happen that you have more contested elections at the beginning of a plan, and that as the parties see how districts perform, they end up not supporting candidates to run in what would be what they think are probably hopeless endeavors, although we have seen some hopeless endeavors ultimately turn around with surprising victories in some districts in Wisconsin. So you're basically, what you're using as a baseline is a made-up number. It's votes that were never cast in an election that never happened. Or you're going to use some kind of a baseline type of election, like the presidential election, and just presume that that's how they would perform in different elections, whether it be Senate or state Senate or United States Congress or a state assembly race. Second criticism, I think, is that the technique is overly sensitive insofar as there's linear relationships between what are wasted votes and a vote total within a district until you get to the 50% number, and then you have a gigantic flip. And so what this means is that you're going to have a higher efficiency gap score, or a map may look like it's more partisan merely because you have more competitive districts, or one party versus the other party ends up winning more of these close elections, right? So, I mean, we'll take a non-gerrymandered example. If you've got 15 districts and, you know, five of the districts are 66-33% Republican, five are 66-33% Democrat, and five are 50-50. You know, when you have an example of, say, the Democrats winning all of those 50-50 elections by one seat, that map would score to be a pretty extraordinary Democrat gerrymander, when we know that it isn't. The last thing is that the theory doesn't account for the fact that districts don't produce the same number of votes, right? In some districts in Wisconsin, for example, I think our equal population number is around 57,000 for an assembly district, 57,500, something like that. You know, in some districts, we see 8,000 votes in a contested election. And in some districts, we see 40,000 votes in a contested election for an assembly candidate. And because the efficiency gap theory is treating all votes the same, it will identify gerrymanders that are really just due to voter turnout, or the fact that one district has a lot more people who are voting eligible than another district. So an example of this is, you know, imagine two districts, both are 60-40. One district has 400 people vote in it, let's use 400. The other district has 100 people vote in it, right? That's a ratio that exists in Wisconsin. Under the efficiency gap theory, in the 100 seat, 60-40 election, let's say the Democrats were the winners in that one. In that election, they wasted 9 votes, and the Republicans wasted 40. In the other district, Republicans ultimately, let's see, their vote total in a 60-40 election would be 240 to 160, so they wasted 39 votes, and Democrats wasted 160 votes in that election. Well, even though the statewide vote, right, would have been like 56% for Republicans, the efficiency gap would identify that as being a pretty significant Republican gerrymandered map, and because of the number of wasted votes that Democrats had versus the number of wasted votes that Republicans have. So I think that, you know, those examples, obviously, you know, they're to be illustrative of problems. When you have more districts, et cetera, some of those concerns are not as pronounced, but I think they do illustrate that the efficiency gap doesn't necessarily do a good job at identifying a gerrymander or the extent of the gerrymander.
Grace, maybe it makes sense for me just to offer a couple of quick thoughts in response to that.
Of course. That's Professor Stephanopoulos. Go right ahead, Professor.
Great. So I think Kevin raised a number of both methodological and conceptual potential concerns with the efficiency gaps. Let me just quickly run through them and offer what I think are the most persuasive responses to those points. So the first point was that there are lots of uncontested races. And so somehow estimates have to be made about how those races would have performed if they had been contested. And this is not really a criticism that applies to the efficiency gap per se. It applies to any measure that would like to have district-specific data about voters' preferences. And there are a number of social scientific techniques varying levels of sophistication that allow us to estimate the preferences of voters in those uncontested races. The best approach, and the approach that was used here, is to consider all the data we do have about those uncontested races. So how they performed in previous years, whether there was an incumbent running or not, even more importantly, what the presidential or the gubernatorial vote was in those districts. And then using all that information, we can come up with extremely accurate models that that impute the results in those uncontested races. And none of the imputations that plaintiffs' experts came up with here were ever challenged. In fact, they seem to be very reliable predictors of the district's performances in other elections. But again, that's not an efficiency gap issue. It's an issue with any measure that cares about district-level performance. A second point was that the efficiency gap problematically relies on statewide vote and seat data, whereas all we have in the American system are a series of district-specific elections. And actually, one of the really nice advantages of the efficiency gap is that it doesn't rely on statewide data. You know, the efficiency gap tallies the party's respective wasted votes individual district by individual district. There's no need to ever consider a party's statewide vote share or a party's statewide seat share in calculating the sort of the full robust form of the efficiency gap. This actually distinguishes the efficiency gap from essentially all other measures of gerrymandering, which do focus exclusively on statewide statistics. A third point was the efficiency gap's sensitivity to competitive elections, you know, to elections that are near the 50-50 point. And again, this is not really a point about the efficiency gap. This is a point about the nature of seats in a winner-take-all single-member district system. You know, it's not the efficiency gap that's volatile, it's seats that are volatile. It's seats that flip from being Democratic to Republican if the vote goes from 50% minus one to 50% plus one. The efficiency gap's, you know, alleged volatility is simply a reflection of how seats operate in the American system. And moreover, because the efficiency gap, like seats, does have this element of volatility, That's exactly why plaintiffs have never contended that a large efficiency gap alone ought to be enough to condemn a district plan. You always want to be confident that the large efficiency gap that you observe would endure even under different electoral conditions. So if it's true that a large efficiency gap is the product of one party sweeping all the 50-50 districts, that map would have zero prospect of liability under the plaintiff's approach, because as soon as you try to estimate what might happen with that map under different electoral circumstances, you would find out that the efficiency gap could easily vanish or go in the opposite direction if there were relatively minor changes in voters' preferences. So I think the full test that we've advocated in front of the court fully takes into account the volatility of seats and therefore the volatility of measures that are based on who wins and who loses each seat. Final thing about the efficiency gap being sensitive to variations in district turnout. Again, a really nice feature of the efficiency gap is that it directly incorporates differential district turnout. So if a party is winning large turnout districts and losing low turnout districts, all of that information is fully incorporated into the party's respective wasted votes and therefore into the calculation of the efficiency gap. Again, other metrics lack this sensitivity to differential district turnout because they don't focus district by district on the outcomes. The efficiency gap avoids that problem by tallying all wasted votes individual district by individual district. It actually allows us to distinguish between turnout effects on the efficiency gap and other kinds of effects on the efficiency gap. We can actually parcel out what percent of the efficiency gap is due to differential turnout versus what percentage is due to just sort of general partisan bias in a map. And so this is sort of getting quite into the weeds, but maybe that helps to answer some of Kevin's concerns about the metric.
This is Dean Reuter. Once again, our lines are wide open. If you have a question, now is the time. Push the star button, then the pound button on your telephone. Star button and then pound button. While we're waiting to see who might ring in, let me make an announcement about our next upcoming Teleforum conference call. I don't think this has been announced on our website or by email, but tomorrow at 4 p.m. Eastern Time, we'll be discussing the Department of Justice's announced intent to revisit the Yates memo. That's as to prosecutions of corporate crimes. Today, of course, we're talking about Gill versus Whitford, political gerrymandering. Push the star button, then the pound button if you have a question. Let me see if I can formulate a question here. I'm wondering what to what extent the motives of the redistricting committee or body play in this analysis. Is there any hint here that there's a use of party affiliation as a proxy for race? Does that matter? And I want to get back to the constitutional issue that Kevin St. John raised. Is it good enough just to say if you win at the state level, if you control the state house, essentially you can control redistricting? Why isn't that good enough? And I guess that's a question for Professor Stephanopoulos.
I'd like to get back to the underlying constitutional question here. Why are we concerned about partisan gerrymandering? And is it right that the Constitution doesn't express any sorts of limits or views on descriptive or substantive representation? So I think a lot of what I heard earlier from Kevin really should have been raised in 1986 when the court announced the creation of the cause of action for partisan gerrymandering. If in fact we don't care about how statewide votes at all translate into statewide seats, if all we have are individual district elections and that's all there is, then the court made a grave error in 1986 in announcing the cause of action for partisan gerrymandering. But once we have the cause of action, it's pretty obvious that the core definition of partisan gerrymandering is a district plan that enables one party to more efficiently, more effectively translate its popular support into representation in the legislature. You know, that's always been the meaning of a partisan gerrymander. And so once that exists as a legal theory recognized under the Constitution by the Supreme Court, it seems a little bit late in the day to argue that, in fact, the Constitution doesn't impose any sorts of limits on this activity. You know, for better or worse, that ship has sailed, I think. And I should note, too, the variety of ways in which the Constitution has been held to regulate representation in the U.S. and to express specific views on both descriptive and substantive representation. So with respect to descriptive representation, there is also a constitutional cause of action for racial vote dilution. So in fact, minority groups and minority members can sue under the Constitution when there has been the deliberate, intentional dilution of minority votes, usually through redistricting. This constitutional theory has been complemented by an even more potent theory under the Voting Rights Act. But the Voting Rights Act theory is just an echo of the constitutional theory. So the Constitution itself has been held to express views on descriptive representation for minorities. And then the one person, one vote cases amount to yet another representational insertion by the Supreme Court. There are lots of different theories of representation that don't require population equality. You know, theories based on representing counties, on representing particular regions of the state. And yet again, the court, notwithstanding this plethora of valid representational theories, the court intervened in the 1960s and announced the constitutional principle of population equality. So I think there's nothing novel going on here. There's nothing that threatens the basic foundations of the American electoral system. All we have is the latest in a long, robust line of judicial interventions to promote fairness and to promote certain particular modes of representation in the American system. And we've seen this with one person, one vote. We've seen it with the racial vote dilution cases. And we saw it in 1986 with the creation of the partisan gerrymandering cause of action. We've had a failure of judicial will to enforce the prohibition on partisan gerrymandering. But that failure of judicial will is quite different from any of the theoretical problems that that Kevin was alluding to earlier.
I have a couple responses, one to what Nick just said and one to the original question that also dealt with intent. As to responding to Professor Stephanopoulos, I don't think that the ship sailed in 1986. I mean, I think that clearly if you look at the Veith case, I mean, you not only have four justices that say it's not justiciable, but you have additional justices who would have held that a statewide partisan gerrymandering claim, a claim that's made independent of individual problems with the district, that those claims would not be recognized by the court. And so, you know, I think that we would be fooling ourselves if we thought that, you know, the court has a doctrine at the end of the day that it is going to be duty-bound to follow, and it will be up to the advocates in this court to, in some ways, to revisit many first principles. And on those first principles, I think that's a good segue to sort of the question about intent. I think that one of the most perverse things, or I should say inversion of constitutional norms, parts of the argument that the challengers are raising, is that they say ultimately that because intent plays a role, a map that would be drawn by a court or a commission could be constitutional when the lines that are drawn by a legislature, the exact same lines, would not be constitutional. And I think that this is extremely problematic, especially when we're dealing in a world where we're not dealing with a protected class, we're not dealing with strict scrutiny, we're just dealing with any sort of basis for drawing the lines the way that the lines are drawn, and conformity with traditional principles is certainly one. Importantly, I think the court has recognized repeatedly that legislative bodies are sort of presumed that they're going to act with some legislative bodies are political bodies, and it's sort of presumed that they're going to act with some kind of a political or partisan motivation. They've recognized that, and yet, right, the primary place of districting has been placed by the Constitution of the United States and the state legislatures when it comes to congressional apportionment or congressional district line drawing. And at the state level in Wisconsin and in most states, that responsibility, again, rests with the legislature. In other words, there was an awareness of what this potential problem was at the founding, and yet we still chose the institution that may be influenced somewhat by partisan motivation. But I don't think that the jig is lost in terms of the values of proportional representation or the values of, what I say, the values that are translating the public will into policy. Time and time again, we have seen that extreme gerrymanders end up resulting in cutting lines too thin and majorities losing elections. You know, one of the reasons it hasn't happened in Wisconsin, one is it wasn't a thin gerrymander at all, but two is Republican candidates have done so well in election after election after election, and they're not a minority party. There are multiple case-specific reasons about Wisconsin. But more broadly, we have a lot of different institutional components that are not the court that would correct what would be perceived gerrymandering problem. We have, again, a bicameral legislature. We have the opportunity to elect two different legislators. We elect a different executive on a statewide basis. They have the ability to forge a different kind of a consensus in a redistricting law, or they have the ability to veto a law and ultimately have it go to the courts just because of an impasse as opposed to a judicial intervention due to the creation of a new theory of a statewide partisan gerrymandering claim. And those responsive parts of our system should be allowed, I think, to work, because the alternative is judicial intervention in every single state map, local map, town, county, city, school board, because the theory would hold as a constitutional theory that if the legislative body had some kind of a partisan motivation involved and they were effective in translating that partisan motivation into a result, we have a federal case. And I think that ultimately that has an extreme effect on the ability of different legislative bodies to do the work of legislative bodies.
We do have one more caller question, so let's see if we can squeeze this in.
Yes, good afternoon. Does gerrymandering also involve populations of illegal aliens? And if it does, how do we better enforce existing laws?
Either of our experts want to take a shot at that? It's merely maybe a little bit beyond the contours of this case, but...
I don't think it directly involves illegal aliens. At the end of the day, the one person, one vote rule requires legislators to draw districts based upon the persons that are in those districts. There is sort of some, there could be some wiggle room in that analysis, but I don't see any kind of direct factual connection in any of the cases that I'm familiar with that phenomenon. Nick, do you have a different answer?
No, I think I agree with that. You know, we're focused here on district and state level vote shares, and so illegal aliens are not voting, so they're not really relevant to the, you know, either the quantitative analysis of gerrymandering or I think the legal analysis. I guess if they were voting in large numbers, then maybe that would have some impact. But I think the behavior and the attitudes of non-voters and people who aren't even eligible to vote is not that relevant to partisan gerrymandering.
Okay, thank you.
Well, gentlemen, we are just about out of time. We are certainly out of questions, so I want to thank both of you for participating today. This sounds like a very complicated matter to be argued in front of the U.S. Supreme Court 2 weeks from now. So thank you for your time and for your thoughtful presentations and responses to questions. I want to thank the audience as well for dialing in and for your questions. A reminder to our audience about our next scheduled Teleforum conference call. That's tomorrow at 4 p.m. We'll be talking about the Department of Justice's announced intent to revisit the Yates memo. That's the prosecution of corporate crimes. But until that next call, we are adjourned. Thank you very much, everyone.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed this Practice Group podcast. For materials related to this podcast and other Federalist Society multimedia, please visit the Federalist Society's website at fedsoc.org/multimedia.